The scripture I'll be reading this morning comes from Matthew chapter 20, verses 1 through 16. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for the usual daily wage, he sent them into his vineyard. When he went out about 9 o'clock, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and he said to them, "You also go into the vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right." So they went. When he went out again about noon and about 3 o'clock, he did the same. And about 5 o'clock, he went out and found others standing around. And he said to them, "Why are you standing here idle all day?" They said to him, "Because no one has hired us." He said to them, "You also go into the vineyard." When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his manager, "Call the laborers and give them their pay, beginning with the last and then going to the first." When those hired about 5 o'clock came, each of them received the usual daily wage. Now, when the first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received the daily wage. And when they received it, they grumbled against the landowner, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for the usual daily wage? Take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last the same as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or are you envious because I am generous?" So the first will be last. So the last will be first, and the first will be last. This is the word of the Lord. If you're familiar with this parable at all, I want you to imagine kind of coming to it for the first time in this setting. Sometimes I've found that if we know a story, if we've heard a story several times, we tend to kind of fill in details, we tend to jump to the end, we tend to kind of assume we already know the lesson, we seem to kind of fill in the gaps prematurely, and it doesn't affect us in quite the same way on repeated readings as it does the first time. And so I want you to just imagine kind of hearing this story of this landowner who keeps hiring people throughout the day and pays them all the same wage. I want you to imagine that story from the perspective of one who has worked the full day in the heat of the sun. Maybe it would be helpful for you to think of your own work experience, think of a particularly difficult job you've had, a particularly difficult day of work. When I do this, I think of my very first job. I was 16 years old, and I worked as a gas station attendant. Awesome first job. This particular gas station I worked at, it was a very large gas station in Southern Oregon. And they were really very committed to a couple things. They were committed to having the cheapest gas in the valley, which this was a time when gas prices were particularly high. And so the cheapest gas in the valley meant something. It meant we always had a steady stream of cars coming in. Literally throughout an entire afternoon, we would have kind of full pumps all the time. And then they also really emphasized customer service. So like if I was a gas station attendant, I would have like 6 pumps, 3 little islands that were all mine. And I was taught that basically like run from car to car so that they see that we're doing our best to like serve people as quickly and efficiently as possible. So, but it was actually a stressful job because as I mentioned, gas prices were particularly high. And even though our gas prices were lower than the rest of the gas prices in the valley, they weren't necessarily lower than other parts of the country or even other parts of the state. So I remember on multiple occasions, people would come up to the gas station, and I remember one particular guy, he got out, and our gas, I think at that time, it was being sold for like $1.33 a gallon. And this guy gets out and he says, "I was in Georgia, and they're selling gas for 87 cents a gallon." And I said, "Wow, that makes me want to move to Georgia." And then he kind of looks at me, and he thinks I'm like making fun of his observation, and he unleashes a stream of words, which I will not repeat to you, but it's probably like the strongest feedback of that kind I've ever received. And part of his underlying belief there was that in some way I was profiting off of these high gas prices, and I didn't have the heart to explain to him in that moment, like, I am a minimum wage employee. Like, these high gas prices are not going into my pocket. But anyway, it was a surprisingly stressful job because of interactions with that. But one day in particular was very stressful. I was filling up a boat, and the gas pump shut off when the boat was full, as gas pumps are programmed to do. And so I walk over, and I pull the hose out of the boat, and I'm kind of holding it like this, about to put it back in its holster. And for whatever reason, I still don't know why, but the gas pump turns on as I'm holding it like this. And so this stream of gas immediately just like sprays me in the eye. And I'm standing there holding this pump, like all of a sudden getting sprayed with this full steam of gas. And so I instinctively drop the hose, which now starts kind of whipping around, spraying the side of this boat. And I fall on my knees, and I'm like crying out in pain. I feel like I'm blinded, like I can't see anything. The stinging is so bad. Meanwhile, the guy who's standing there, I was filling up his boat, he doesn't really offer to help me. He just looks at his boat and goes, "My boat!" Like, what's going on? Fortunately, I had a coworker, and she knew what to do. In the 5 minutes of training that you get before being hired as a gas station attendant, you're prepared for this situation. You're told there is an emergency shutoff valve. If for whatever reason gas starts spreading all over the place, hit the shutoff valve. So she hits the valve and then comes running over to me, and she's like, "Bro, we got to get you inside." And she grabs me by like the collar of my shirt and just starts kind of walking me inside. I literally can't see out of my right eye. I can see just a little bit out of my left eye. I can see my best friend, Josh. He was my best friend all throughout high school. We had this job together. It was awesome. We got to work together every day. And I can see Josh is like keeled over in laughter. He is showing no support to me whatsoever. But this other coworker, she was on it. She takes me inside, and inside the convenience store, we kind of had a deli in the back, and behind the deli, there was like a dishwashing sink with one of the big hoses that you use for that. So the guy behind the counter, he knew that in the event that you spray gas in your eyes, there's this specific kind of eye drops that you're supposed to flush out your eyes with, and that they're located in the kitchen next to the sink. That was not covered in my 5 minutes of training, so I'm really grateful that that my coworker happened to know that. So he takes me in, and he kind of puts my head down in the sink, and he's like flushing out my eyes and dropping in eye drops. And after a while, I began to regain some vision, and the stinging kind of subsided. My hair still smelled like gasoline. It smelled like gasoline for like a week afterwards. I was terrified that somebody was going to light up a cigarette around me and that I was just going to like burst into flames. But you might find it interesting to know that when you spray gas in your face at this particular gas station, that's not like a free ticket home for the rest of the afternoon. I kind of thought at that point they might be like, "You know, you've had a long day." Like, but what they did do is they said, "Here, you should probably change your shirt." And they gave me a shirt, and I went back out there, and I finished the shift, because as I said, we were very committed to customer service. So as I think about that story, in the light of this parable, I think about how would I have reacted? You know, I had these coworkers, excluding my friend Josh, who we'll leave that alone, but I had these coworkers that, like, there was a great sense of camaraderie. One of them hits the shutoff valve and gets me inside. The other one flushed out my eyes. Like, we kind of bonded over this moment. And I'm thinking, what if there was another coworker that showed up like with 1 hour left in the workday and clocks in and clocks out, and the manager just kind of says, "Yeah, you'll get paid what the rest of them got paid. You know, it's like you were here all day." On that particular day, I think I would have been a little bit angry. I think I would have been a little bit resentful. Like, well, they didn't earn that. Like, at least let's spray them in the face with gasoline, and then we can say they earned it, right? So when I kind of read this story from that perspective, there's a sense in which I feel that this parable is a little bit scandalous. It's describing a landowner compensating his employees in a way that, I mean, none of us would take a job where compensation worked this way, where the ones who showed up for 1 hour got the same as the ones that were there all day. Like, that's not a business practice that would work in our day and age. Yet that is how Jesus chooses to describe the kingdom of heaven. That is how Jesus chooses to describe the kingdom of heaven. So then I look at this parable and I try to read it from a different perspective. I read it for a second time from the perspective of those that are arriving at the end of the day, those that are the last to get invited in at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, thinking they won't find work that day. And they're invited to come and work for an hour, and then they're given a full wage for that hour. You know, there could be any number of reasons why one might be the last one who's hired. Maybe they're the ones that didn't have their references in order, those whose resumes don't measure up. Maybe they have mental or physical capabilities which were limited, and the one doing the hiring didn't think they were up to the job. Maybe they had a criminal record. Maybe they had a history of substance abuse. Maybe they were lazy. Maybe they were just simply unlucky. They got a flat tire that day. There are all kinds of reasons why some have been pushed to the margins. There's all kinds of reasons why some are left behind. They vary in each individual case. As I think about my own life in connection with this story, I think I've come to understand this parable differently just in the last couple of years. My wife and I, we moved here to Central Oregon just under 2 years ago. It was coming up on the end of December. We both finished grad school. We lived in a housing situation where our lease was set to expire. We both had jobs that were temporary jobs that were running out, kind of student-type jobs. And so we needed to move somewhere. And we had this discussion, and it was like, oh, where should we move? We kind of thought about trying to stay in Southern California. I was from Oregon, so I liked the idea of moving back to Oregon. And we actually ended up, we moved here, not because one of us got a job to move here. We moved here so that my wife could pursue a volunteer internship with a local nonprofit organization. So my parents loved this plan, by the way. So as we were talking about the possibility of moving here, I mentioned to a friend of mine who lived in Redmond, and we had stayed at their house before, and I mentioned, you know, hey, we're talking about moving to Central Oregon. It could be pretty exciting. Well, my hope was to get a job before we moved, and so I'm applying to jobs in the area, including one job that I thought was like a perfect fit, and I didn't get it. And so it gets to be near the end of December, and we don't really have anything lined up, but we know we have to leave. And so I called this friend again. This friend lives in Redmond. And I said, I think we're moving to Oregon at the beginning of January, but we don't really have a place to live because I don't have a job yet. And this friend of mine says, you know what, we prepared the guest room for you when I first got your message that you were moving here. So you're free to come and stay as long as you need to stay. And I said, well, that is very gracious of you. Like, I'm hoping a couple weeks, like a month at the most. Like, I just need time to, you know, like I said, get a job, find a place to live, taken care of, right? So we move to Redmond, and I start applying for jobs throughout Central Oregon, and a week goes by, a couple weeks go by, and I'm not really getting anything back on those job opportunities, and that's fine. I just keep applying for more, but it's getting near the end of January, and I'm realizing that I'm just not going to have a job by the end of January. And so we sit down with this couple at their dining room table, and I'll never forget this conversation. I said, it's kind of slow going out there. And they said, Mark, you can stay here as long as you need to. We're not going to kick you out next week. Like, you can stay here as long as you need to stay here. And I said, you know, well, I really thought I'd have a job by now. And the husband of this family, he's a construction worker. And he'd actually been laid off for about 6 months during the recession in 2008. And he looks at me and he says, Mark, you can't beat yourself up over this. Like, you just got to give it time. But you are always welcome here. You are always welcome here. And so I said, okay, well, we just need a couple more weeks. Thank you so much. Well, a couple more weeks turns into month number two. Month number two turns into month number three. Month number three turns into month number four. By this time, I've applied for over 40 different jobs. I've applied for jobs I was overqualified for and jobs I was underqualified for and jobs I thought I was perfectly qualified for, and nothing is coming to fruition. It was finally 5 months of living with this particular couple who showed hospitality and generosity that I've never experienced before. And took 5 months before I finally got a job. Thank you, First Presbyterian, for hiring me. What was interesting about that time is the fear that would creep up in my mind, and it was a fear of, is there enough? Like, do we have enough? Like, can we make it? Like, are we doing something that is unwise and this is just not going to work out? And there were moments, you know, we had this family that was incredibly generous and provided us a place to stay, and they didn't charge us for rent, but we still had expenses, we still had groceries that we were buying, we still had gas needed to put in our cars and things like that, and we were like broke when we moved to Oregon, so living 5 months in this way like just made us more broke. And as I think back over that time, there were different times where Steph and I would sit down and we'd kind of look at what was in our checking account and we'd say, well, I think we can like make it through this week. Like, I think we can get enough gas and food to kind of make us through this week, and then I don't know what we're going to do. And we'd have that conversation, and then the next day, a check would show up in the mail from friends that knew our situation but didn't know our situation, if you know what I mean. Like, they knew that we didn't have work, but we never said to them anything like, we literally don't have money to make it through the next week. But checks would come in the mail. Sometimes they would come from different parties on the same day. Sometimes they would come from the same people on the same day of each month. And there was a sense of, in our fear of wondering, is this enough? Do we have enough? Is there enough to go around? That there would be these continual moments of grace, of saying, yes, there is enough. Yes, there is enough. You know, going without work is hard. It takes a psychological toll. And even with these acts of grace kind of marking that time, it was very difficult to receive that kind of help. We live in a culture that often associates one's value or one's significance with what they produce. And so if you're not producing anything, you start to wonder, what is my value? What is my significance? So now when I read this parable from the perspective of one who has been out of work, I find it to be really good news. I don't find these words to be so scandalous anymore. I find them to be hopeful. I find them ultimately to be a reason for gratitude. It's why I chose this parable for Thanksgiving weekend, because I wanted a parable that inspired in me some thoughts of gratitude. Gratitude is kind of a loaded term, depending on how it's used. You know, for people who have experienced tragedy, for people who are in the midst of really hard times, sometimes just simply telling them to be grateful, telling them to count their blessings, that, like, sometimes that's not very helpful. Sometimes it doesn't really come from a place of empathy to what they're going through. I think about sometimes, I don't know if it works like this in your house, but sometimes if Steph and I are like cleaning our house, like say we have people coming over for dinner in like an hour, and we just kind of look around and we're like, wow, okay. Like, so we start cleaning, but the cleaning is more like opening up a drawer and throwing things in, or opening up a closet and throwing things in, or opening up a bedroom and throwing things in. Like, that it's not really dealing with the mess, it's hiding the mess. and then it's just kind of pretending that that mess isn't actually there. Sometimes I feel like I hear gratitude being encouraged to be shared in kind of a way that pretends the mess isn't there. You know, that it's like, let me just ignore the things that are really keeping me up at night, the things that are filling my life with anxiety, the things that are overwhelming me, the things that are making me want to give up. I'm being told to just kind of put those things aside and to just put on a happy face and kind of say how thankful I am for the things that are in my life. And I don't want us to think about gratitude in those terms this morning. That's not what I'm hoping to do. I'm hoping to think of a gratitude that exists within the mess. I think about what I served as a youth pastor for several years at a church in Jacksonville, Oregon, down near Medford, and we would have a Thanksgiving service every year on Wednesday night before Thanksgiving. And there was no sermon to it. There was just an open mic sharing time where they would invite people to come forward and share what they're thankful for. And I was, every year I was astounded because the people who would come up and share weren't the people for whom life had been the smoothest. They were people usually that had experienced some profound tragedy in their life recently, and that it had caused them to think about gratitude in a new light. It was somebody might come up and share about the terminal illness diagnosis that they'd had and how that had caused them to value time with their grandkids more. Some would talk about the death of a loved one and how other friends had come around to support them in a way they'd never experienced before during that time. Others might talk about the loss of a job or other similar trials, and they would talk about gratitude from a place that was really rooted in a lot of heartache, a lot of pain. They weren't stories of God kind of removing the mess from their lives. They were stories of God showing up in the midst of that mess. This parable, I think it gives us an idea of something of a God who shows up in the mess. This is not a God who is content to stay with those who can put in a full day's work, those who can earn their keep. Sometimes I fear that that's what we make religion into, is this God who kind of responds to us in our ability to kind of keep things all together, and that if we keep things all together, then we're somehow staying in connection or in relationship with God. But this is a God who continually returns to the margins, to those who've been left behind, to those who are forgotten. This is a God who brings hope to the hopeless, who brings healing to the wounded, who brings new life to those who are left for dead. That's the kind of story I hold on to at a time like this. That's the kind of story that gives me some sense of gratitude. I hope that's a source of gratitude for you this morning. Now for an awkward transition, we're going to transition to the offering. Which actually, no, that's great, because we're supposed to take part in the offering from a place of gratitude, right? So I want to invite the ushers and the music team to prepare for the offering.